Good evening and welcome to Music of the Metroplex. I'm your host, Kevin Sutton. Tonight, my guests are two internationally recognized composers who make their home right here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Simon Sargon is professor of composition at Southern Methodist University in Dallas. He was born in Bombay, India in 1938 and was brought to the United States as an infant. His early training was at Brandeis University, and he studied piano with the world-renowned Mieczysław Horsowski. He went to the Juilliard School, where he studied composition. He's a diverse and prolific composer. Simon Sargon's works include work for orchestra, operas, oratorios, and chamber music. Joseph Klein is the chair of the composition department at the University of North Texas in Denton. He holds degrees from Indiana University, the University of California at San Diego, and the California State Polytechnic University at Pomona. Dr. Klein's music covers a broad spectrum of method and media. He often utilizes electronically generated sounds and frequently couples his musical creations with the visual arts. Simon, Joseph, good evening and welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you.
Thank you.
Let me ask you both a question to start out with. Why do you write music?
Simon, I'll let you take this one first.
Well, I mean, the question of the reason for creativity is fairly simple, I think. It's that one has a need to express oneself, one's feelings, one's attitude towards the world that surrounds them. And for me, it's just always been a necessity to try to express those feelings.
Do you think that you, do either of you write music for posterity, or is it just something you have to release from your own spirit and put down on paper? Of course you care if people listen to your music, otherwise you wouldn't eat, but is it for you or is it for them?
Well, I would say for me, personally, it's a very individual thing. I mean, you're right, you hope that other people enjoy your creations and what you sweat over, but I think ultimately the composer, him or herself, is the final arbiter of the work and the success of the work or not. And so for me, I think it's a personal thing, maybe a selfish thing, I guess.
I know a lot of performers don't like to hear playbacks of themselves singing or playing. It bothers them. How do you feel about listening to your own music?
I enjoy it if it's a good performance.
And how often does that happen?
That's true. That makes all the difference, that's for sure. Although, well, in the case of like the tape medium, if you're working with electronic music, then, you know, you're really, the only limitations are the equipment you're playing back on. But I agree with Simon. I mean, if it's a good performance, it can be a really rewarding experience to hear your work come back at you.
Once you've put it down on paper, do you leave it alone and let the performer do with it what they will, or are you a meddling composer when you're sitting out there listening to rehearsals?
Oh, I suppose you could call me a meddler. I like to coach how to perform the music. But to refer back to your question a moment ago, I usually write for specific performers, so it's great to hear the piece when these performers play it, because it's written for their strengths. And when they realize it, it's very satisfying for me to hear the completed product.
Very nice.
Yeah, actually, that's a good point, because, in fact, in my situation, I think about some of the performers I've worked with, and in particular, there are two friends of mine that are really fine trombonists, but they're very different kinds of trombonists, and I've written pieces for each of them. And in the cases where one will play the piece written for the other, it seems like a very inappropriate fit, you know? I mean, you can really tell that the piece is not for that person, and it's so it makes me realize that, you know, how tailor-made some of my music really is for the person I'm writing for.
Gentlemen, let me ask you another philosophical question. Is there an avant-garde, and if so, what are they doing that's new?
If you don't mind me jumping in here
first. Go right ahead.
I mean, I'll make the first stab at this, but, you know, it's funny. I teach at UNT, I teach the freshman composers, and it's kind of a survey of the 20th century and into the 21st century now, and we spend the last part of it talking about postmodernism, which is really refreshing, because all that stuff we looked at that went in cycles and phases and each movement, you know, overtook another movement and reacted against it, it's really interesting in postmodernism to see that all those things kind of have been stuck in the blender and mixed together. And what composers, I find really interesting, have just taken from all the different, the plethora of different techniques and styles and aesthetics, not only from the past 100 years, but even in previous generations. To some extent what Stravinsky was doing with his neoclassical music, but I think even more broad because it gets into popular music and rap music and jazz and all different kinds of styles, ethnomusics, of course. And I think that's, to me, I guess that's the closest to what you might call avant-garde, although I don't think it has the same ramifications as that term did in the 60s, perhaps.
Simon, let me ask you. There is a huge revival of early music. I mean, just the other day I received some review copies of music by Hildegard, for example, some of the oldest stuff around, and it's very fresh to my ears. And there's a whole completist movement going on with all the recordings of every single piece of music practically ever written. What's left to say?
There's always something new to say. I don't think we've ever exhausted the possibilities, and I think that it's just a question of reframing in a way. I mean, human emotions don't change, but I think it's a question that each generation has to reframe the emotions in their own particular style. I want to go back to your other question, and I don't know if Joe agrees with me, but I'd be interested to hear about the avant-garde. Would you consider performance art the one really, truly avant-garde element today that's sort of breaking into new areas?
If you're talking about the kind of the extension of the 60s performance art, I mean, the same kinds of
things. Are we talking
things,
about Laurie Anderson?
Yeah, that's what I want to think.
Well, yeah, actually, I mean, if you look at someone like Laurie Anderson, let's say, or Diamanda Galas or something like that, maybe, yeah, I guess that's probably the closest thing that you could have to what, you know, we think of as avant-garde, cutting edge, or whatnot, but there's a kind of softening to that as well, you know? I mean, it's a
right.
lot more accessible than I think anything that came out of the 60s was that you might label that way.
Exactly.
Because we can't consider minimalism or any of those, that type of movement avant-gardist in nowadays any longer, and I don't know that there's anything to replace that in terms of a movement per se, but performance art is just sort of wide open as to what the performer will introduce into performing. And from that point of view, I think it has elements of avant-garde in it.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Well, Joe, I know that I've heard a lot of your music, and I know that some of it can be, out there. You experiment with a lot of sonorities and a lot of different things. And up next is a piece of yours entitled Dog, in which your wife is going to be performing. Heidi Dietrich Klein, a fine singer in her own right. Describe this piece for us.
This piece was written in 1997, and actually the impetus for the piece came from this trombonist friend of mine, one of the two trombonists I mentioned earlier, who wanted a work for trombone and electronics and male voice based upon a poem named Leviathan by the American poet W.S. Merwin. And I read the poem, and I really liked the poem, and I wanted to look at more of Merwin's poetry, and in exploring that, I found part of a bestiary, a kind of collection of poems on animals that Merwin wrote, I believe it was in the 50s, if I'm not mistaken, and one of the poems in there was Dog, and actually that poem attracted me even more than the Leviathan poem, and so much to my friend's consternation that I wasn't working on his piece first, I started to work on this one, and it was a chance for me to incorporate a number of elements, musical elements that I find interesting. I'm interested in multimedia, video, electronic sounds, etc. So this includes, in addition to the female voice, bassoon, lighting effects, video, electronic music, etc.
Simon, you had a follow-up comment about my earlier question concerning the avant-garde, where Joe's choice of media were concerned.
Yes, when I heard the forces that he was using for this piece and the way he was stretching the performance envelope, that's what I was referring to. This is where I think the contemporary avant-garde is. This is where there's room to explore that's totally new and people can go on the cutting edge.
Yeah, I think that because of the facilities we have at the University of North Texas with the Center for Experimental Music and Intermedia, we have a lot of opportunities for students and faculty both to use video and various kinds of sonic media, including multi-channel sound projections, in addition to performance between the performers, instrumentalists, singers, actors, etc., lighting. And in fact, that's what I kind of thought Simon was getting at previous to the playing of the piece there.
Exactly. It's totally new combinations, totally new use of different elements in a piece.
Unfortunately, the restraints of time keep us from having 2 and 3 hour conversations about these fascinating topics, and I wish we could, but we're going to move on now to a piece of chamber music by Simon Sargon, a piece called Clear Midnight for baritone voice, that is, horn and piano. When creating a piece of chamber music, do you experiment with sonorities that you think sound good together, or do three of your best friends who happen to play these instruments come up and say, Simon, write me a piece?
Yeah, it's a combination of both of them. In this instance, there aren't a lot of pieces for baritone, horn, and piano because being the baritone voice and the horn, they're more or less in the same range. And so it's a challenge to the composer to create textures that are not too thick or too heavy or where the voice is obliterated by the obbligato instrument. I mean, it's easier to have a soprano singing with a horn because you have two different ranges and colors going there.
Of course, we have a lot of great music for the tenor voice and horn. I'm kind of biased to that, being a tenor.
Oh, yes.
It's a wonderful works by Benjamin Britten. Well, this is a song cycle, I take it.
This is a song cycle of six poems of Walt Whitman. And the first is A Song of Joys, and the second is Nocturne. They were written for Greg Hustis, who's the first horn of the Dallas Symphony, and Donny Ray Albert, a wonderful local singer who's gone on to international prominence. He sings in opera houses throughout the world. Yeah. So I was fortunate to have the recording done with these two extraordinary artists.
Both of you are on the faculties of major universities, and you work with students every day. How do you teach someone to compose?
Well, I don't think you can teach anybody to compose, really. I mean, I guess you can give them the tools, and that's about it. And there may be some argument on this. I mean, that you figure they either have the talent or they don't. And so my job as a teacher, particularly since I teach the freshman composition students, is to just give them as many tools for their toolbox as possible. I always tell them that. It's like you need to have a full toolbox to know what to work with. You don't always need the screwdriver, the hammer, or the wrench at any one time, but it's good to have those things available to you.
Now, I have to ask this. I've sung in my days in graduate school many a new piece by many a composition student, and I just want to know, how does some of that stuff get out of the studio?
How does something get out of the studio? What do you mean?
How does it get to the public? I mean, I've performed some of the wackiest music, some of the most impossible to sing music I think I've ever had. What's the criteria for when a composition's finished and it's all right to throw it out there and let an audience hear it?
Well, I want to go back to how teaching composition. I think that Joe has presented a very useful analogy about it, because you can't really teach a composition in the sense of... the element of the inspiration or the idea can't be taught. What can be imparted is a sense of form and the use of musical means to round out and finalize a composition. And somehow to give the young composer a sense that they have to persevere and keep working on a piece until it's the best that they can make it, and they don't give up on it or try to get away with it.
I know that Frank Bridge used to always make Benjamin Britten walk across the room, and he'd play the piece and insist, "Is that what you meant to say?"
Yeah, see, that's very important. And I think that your question before about pieces getting out, I would say that the instructor is not being careful enough if he allows a piece to go out that's really not vocal, or is written poorly in the range of the voice or whatever. Those things have to be addressed in the composition lesson, and they have to be solved there.
But I think there's a fine line, actually, because it's an interesting, in the university setting, it's a kind of a workshop element as well. I mean, and of course, like, this is the fine line. You don't want to put out bad product and have performers react poorly and get, you know, kind of get a bad reputation over that. At the same time, the students, in a way, need to fall down and hurt themselves occasionally and see that, oh, you know what we talked about in the lesson? Now you know
it
doesn't
work.
Guess
what? This didn't work. Did
and so we have a lot of, at UNT, a lot of reading sessions, so they're not public open performances, but it's a chance for them to workshop the pieces and fine-tune them before they actually go and, you know,
put them
have a big flop
the
in
critics.
Public.
Well, let's go back to one of your pieces now, Jonah. I saw the world premiere of this piece, if I'm not mistaken, and it's quite a fascinating work. It is a multimedia work, as I recall, a piece called Occam's Razor. We're going to hear the music from it. Of course, we can't see the fabulous visuals that went along with this original piece, but tell us something about the two movements of Occam's Razor that we're going to hear.
Actually, this is, I mean, you may be thinking of into the work. This isn't really multimedia in the sense of visual, but there, I would admit that there are a lot of references in there. And actually, one of my favorite composers is Elliot Carter. And what I like about Carter is the fact that in addition to a very rigorous technical language that he has, he makes a lot of references to literature and art, and also kind of a sociological reference in the way his performers interact with each other. And this piece is in 7 movements. Each of the movements makes a reference to a different work of literature, artwork, poet, philosopher, etc. The particular movements that you'll be playing are, one is called Masse und Macht, which is from Elias Canetti, and this is a novel of his, actually not a novel, a large literary work that I believe won the Nobel Prize, if I'm not mistaken, in the early 60s. And the other movement is called Crown Knots and Cascades. It's based on a poem by the American poet Alice Fulton. And these two movements and the other works in the entire piece somehow connect the literature with a kind of a numerological significance, with a kind of a structural basis, and there's a lot of interwebbing that goes on with them.
Gentlemen, let me ask you, do you have a specific process for writing a piece of music, or do things happen spontaneously? Do you have a workaday method?
You know, Kevin, I think each piece takes its own working process. I mean, some pieces you're blessed and it comes to you in no time, and other pieces you struggle with for years and years. And other pieces, it's just a question of working daily for months, and somehow it comes to be into being. But I don't think there's one way it ever happens.
That's a really great answer, and I'm going to let that stand for my answer as well.
Well, you know, you read about some composers who every morning from 9 a.m. to noon went to their desk and wrote music. And then they took lunch, and then from 3 to 5 they wrote more music, and they kept what was good and they threw what was out, but every day they wrote something down. And then you hear about people like, you know, Mozart and Mendelssohn and Prokofiev, for whom music just seem to fly out of their pens at a whim.
From my standpoint, I'd rather have large chunks of time less frequently than more frequent, smaller chunks of time. It just takes way too much time to kind of get into the mindset.
There we go. We're going to close our program this evening with another piece by Simon Sargon. This is a movement from a work called Deep Ellum Nights. Of course, all of our Dallas listeners will be familiar with the Deep Ellum neighborhood of our city and the kind of music that goes on there. How does a serious piece of Western art music fit into Deep Ellum, Simon?
Well, this is a lighter piece for the closing. It was commissioned by the Rockport, Massachusetts Chamber Music Festival, and I wanted to give them something from Texas. So I tried to conjure up a feel of Deep Ellum Nights back in the 30s of Deep Ellum, what it was like. And this piece is called Tempo di Rag. It's a kind of a dance-like rag that I imagined might be a dance done at that time.
And tell us what the instrumentation is and who's performing.
Yes, it's for clarinet and piano. And the clarinetist is Boston-based clarinetist Jonathan Kohler, and the pianist Judith Gordon.
It's been Composer's Night on Music of the Metroplex, and my guests have been Joseph Klein from the University of North Texas and Simon Sargon, who's on the faculty at Southern Methodist University. Gentlemen, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Kevin.
Yes, it's been great, Kevin. Thanks.
Join me next month when I talk with 5 young chamber musicians whose music has an exciting and fresh new twist. Until that time, for the friends of WRR, I'm Kevin Sutton. Good night.
You've been listening to Music of the Metroplex. Join us again the second Sunday of next month. The Friends of WRR invite you to support the arts by calling 214-421-8500. Thanks for listening.